Over there on that table, there's some handouts. Okay. I think we're going to start. Okay, so welcome to, this is week five. I'll just start off with a review first of all. You ready there? We're going to start with just a bit of a review from last week. Last week we started talking about the second emotional triangle, right? So if you look at the back of your handout, there's those two triangles. There's the intellectual triangle, then there's two, what I call the world of emotional response. And then there's a second, the two triangles, Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, and then Netzach, Hod, Yisod. Last week we did Netzach. We explained, first of all, that the second triangle is much more of a functional triangle. The first triangle, Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, is much more emotional. The second is more functional, because it's more of the commitment. We explained that emotions are not always lost and are not always as passionate, as exciting in a consistent way. So that's why we need that functional commitment. And therefore we talked about Netzach. Netzach is the power of winning. It's the power of determination, the power of resilience to overcome the obstacles, to be ambitious, to do what needs to be happening, even if we're not in the mood, even if we have struggles coming from external sources or internal sources of our own personality. But that's the power of Netzach. And we explained that it looks like a second best option, because of course ideally we want to do something with full feeling, full excitement, full passion. But if that's absent, so the kind of the second best is the commitment, the Netzach. But actually it's not that way. Really the truth is that there's an amazing depth to Netzach, as we said, that it actually comes from a very deep place in the soul. A soul to overcome and to be committed and to transcend to something higher than ourselves, even when it's hard. Just before we go into today's discussion, I just want to add something. It's something I've shared with you many years ago, but I'll just share it again because it's beautiful. One of the people who showed this throughout the ages in this tremendous strength was Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Akiva was, first of all, in his own life, he was illiterate until he was 40, but overcame that and became one of the greatest sages in Jewish history. And also he lived in an extremely tough time, an extremely time of persecution under the Roman regime, under the Roman rule. There was prohibition against studying Torah, and he went against them, and he studied and he taught, and he became one of the foundational Talmudists of the entire Talmud. There's a saying that goes with Rabbi Akiva that he would read the Torah. In those days, just to give you the context, in those days very little was written down. It was all explored orally and it was learned orally. That's why we have this concept called next week Shavuot, when we celebrate the anniversary of the giving of the Torah. We know that we believe fundamentally that there's two parts of the Torah. There's the written Torah and the oral Torah. Right? So Rabbi Akiva was like one of the foundations of the oral Torah, and it says that he would know how to interpret the verses of the written Torah in a very deep and profound way. Now, in the Torah, I'm sure I've shared this to you before, there's some letters in the Torah scroll are written in a very particular way. Some letters have crowns on them. They're called, in Hebrew, they're called tagin, which are little crowns on the Zion, on the Shin, on the Tzadik, and so on. And they also look a little bit like small thorns sometimes, right? But they're called tagin, they're crowns. So it says that Rabbi Akiva had the ability to understand the depth behind those crowns. And it says, I'll call kotz v'kotz. This is the expression used in the Gemara, in the Talmud. That on every thorn, with every little thing that stuck out on the letters, he was able to interpret tilei tilim shel halachot, which means mountains of knowledge, mountains of ideas, mountains of Jewish law, and so on. And the commentaries ask the question, why use the expression of kotz? Kotz means a thorn. A thorn seems like a hurtful thing. You get hurt by a thorn, you prick yourself, and so on, right? So why do we say? Why don't we say that he was able to interpret and learn and produce amazing knowledge from the tagin? That's what they normally call the crowns, right? Why does it refer to them as kotzim, which is thorns? And I once heard a very deep idea, and that is, no, it's not just about those thorns. What it really means is what he was experiencing. That I'll call kotz v'kotz on any thorn, in other words, any time he experienced hardship, persecution, challenge, right? He was able to produce, not only he wasn't affected, not only he stayed where he was able to grow. In other words, in spite of the challenge, in spite of the kotzim, in spite of the thorns that damaged him and challenged him and hurt him, he was able to come back and produce even more. He was able to expose mountains of learning from the challenge, despite the challenge. That's the depth of this phrase, I'll call kotz v'kotz. That's the kind of idea of netzach that we tried last week, that ambition to not let challenges get in the way, not let lack of enthusiasm get in the way, not let external hardships get in the way, but just to win the war, to very, very deep power of winning and ambition to overcome all obstacles and produce amazing stuff. Okay, so that's just a little bit of an addition to what we spoke about last week. Before we continue, just a couple of reminders. So next week we take a break. It's Shavuot. Shavuot is Wednesday and Thursday. Shavuot is an important festival. For some reason it's like a little bit ignored sometimes. But actually it's probably the most important festival in Jewish history, in Jewish experience, because it's all the other festivals come from Shavuot, right? We wouldn't know about all the other festivals if we didn't have Shavuot. Shavuot is the time that we experience re-experience and recommit ourselves to the Torah study, Jewish learning, Jewish commitment. We sign our revelation of when we stood at Mount Sinai, all our souls were taught. And we recommitted to the Torah, the Sinai revelation. That was when we became a nation. That was a defining moment in Jewish history. So it's Wednesday and Thursday, hence we're not having a shiur on Thursday. I just want to mention before I go on that actually there's a midrash, a really fascinating midrash, that when on Shavuot we read the Torah, we read the Ten Commandments, because that's what God said on when he was at Sinai. And the midrash says that when we hear the Ten Commandments being read on Shavuot, it's like we're re-experiencing the whole Mount Sinai revelation all over again, right? So I want to encourage everyone to mark Shavuot, and if you can on Wednesday, the first day, if you can make it to Shul and hear the Ten Commandments, it's an amazing thing to be able to do. If you can't make it, at least mark Shavuot in some way. We light candles on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. Tuesday night before sunset, Wednesday night after the stars come out. It's in the calendar. We eat cheesecake, we eat some milk products, so that's another way you can mark Shavuot. But it's an important festival. Okay, so that's next week. We're not having a class, so that's the 13th of June. The following week, which is the 20th of June, we will end the series, the last one of the series, and then we'll have the following week on the 27th of June, we're doing a special Thursday morning, embarrassingly, in honor of my birthday, so a special birthday. So please come along, and I'm actually going to one of the things I'll discuss on that Thursday morning is why I'm doing it. In other words, why I think it's important to mark and celebrate birthdays, and hopefully inspire other people to do the same. Okay, so even though it's embarrassing, but it's important. All right. So today, we're going to go into the fifth trait, right? There's seven traits altogether. In 2 weeks' time, we'll do the last two. but there's seven emotional traits, as we call them, divided into six and the fifth one, which we'll discuss next time. But today we talk about the fifth one, which is the left side of the second triangle. If you look at your handout, it's on the left side of the second triangle. Second emotional triangle is called Chod. Chod, do you see that? Yeah, Chod, on the left side there, which I've translated as humility, but we'll soon see in a second, right? Now, what's interesting is, you know, we talk about the triangles, the right and the left. So in the first emotional triangle, Chesed is on the right, Gevurah is on the left. In the second triangle, Netzach is on the right and Gevurah and Chod is on the left. The truth is, that's by design, because Netzach is connected to Chesed, even though it's different to Chesed, and Chod is connected to Gevurah. So we'll see later that Netzach is ambition, right? We saw last week, it's going, it's moving, it's getting it done, it's overcoming obstacles. That's very much a Chesed thing, where we're giving, we're moving forward, we're moving outwards. That's connected to Chesed. Although it's different, Chesed is with the feeling of love and compassion, Netzach is more the commitment. But Chod, we'll soon see also, Chod is like a surrender more. It's like humility where you hold back. It's the antidote or the balance of Netzach, as we'll discuss in great detail. That's what's on the left. It's more of a Gevurah outcome concept. Okay. So what I want to do is I first want to explain Chod on its own, and then we'll put it together with Netzach and see how they work together. Because just like Chesed and Gevurah had to work together, Chesed without Gevurah or Gevurah without Chesed would be highly problematic. Netzach and Chod is the same thing. On the commitment functional level, Netzach needs Chod and Chod needs Netzach. Okay. So Chod, so it's a Hebrew word, Chod, right? Hey, Vav Dalet. Chod has many translations that you see in different commentaries. Sometimes Chod, it could mean like gratitude, like lehodot in same word as in modern Hebrew, we say Todah Rabba, right? Todah means thank you. But it's also used in the context, you know, Hebrew word, often words mean different things and they're sometimes connected. It also means submission, to be moder, to like, I defer, I agree with you. I'm deferring to you, I'm submitting to you. Or sometimes it can even mean surrender, right? And it could also mean humility, a particular form of humility, as we'll soon see. Now, the idea of sometimes also translated as splendor, but that's another discussion. But submission or humility or gratitude are actually very connected. Just even the word gratitude, when we fill with gratitude, is because like gratitude has to come with a certain sense of humility. Gratitude is the recognition that I don't achieve everything myself, I need other people. I understand the gifts that are being given to me. Excuse me, I understand that God is the source of all blessing. So there's a lot of humility connected to gratitude, and therefore they're all connected. So before we discuss humility in general and break it down or what does humility actually look like, let's just remind ourselves again what I said last week about the difference between those two triangles, the emotional triangle and the functional triangle. That when we talk about Chod being humility, Chod is part of the second triangle, therefore it's a certain type of humility. And just like Netzach, we said it was much more of a functional commitment rather than being a strong feeling of passion, and yet it came from a very deep place. The same thing is with Chod. Chod is an humility, but a functional humility, which we'll explain in a minute, which looks on the surface quite simplistic, but it's actually very deep. So let's explain. Where do we find, from a Jewish perspective, where do we find this idea of submission or surrender in the context of this word Chod? We find it in the very, very beginning of each day. Right, there's the Jewish tradition, Modeh Ani. Exactly, the first thing we say in the morning is Modeh Ani. Now, on a very simple level, the Modeh Ani prayer that we say in the day is gratitude. We thank Hashem, right? Or acknowledge, we realize that we've been asleep. God has woken us up. He's given us another day. Shehechzarta bi nishmati, that you've returned my soul. Because the Talmud says that during the night the soul, or at least part of the soul, ascends heavenward and gets refreshed, rebooted, you know, like you reset a phone. It's a soul each night needs a bit of resetting. And it's given back to us fresh and pure. And that's what we thank Hashem for. We thank God in the morning for giving back our soul and giving us another day and trusting us that we're going to make the day work, right? But actually, it's not just about gratitude. It's also about surrender. Many of the mystics explain this. That Mordeh Ani Lefadecha also means I surrender to you. I defer to you. And the reason for that is because we wake up in the morning and we start the cycle of our Jewishness each morning new. That's what we said, right? It's a new cycle. But it takes time till like we think and we internalize. Most people, when they wake up right away in the morning, they're not extremely intellectual, nor are they extremely emotional. They're just like half dead, right? It takes time to wake up. Right? You wake up, it's a very functional exercise. It takes time till things set in, right? Kabbalistically, this is also true. It says that that's why we have to daven each morning, we have to pray each morning, because each day we start like, you have to understand, right? We've been through the night where our soul and our body has been somewhat disconnected from each other. Yeah? When we wake up in the morning, the soul enters the body, but it takes time for the soul to be internalized. So at that time in the morning, we're like kind of empty. That's why we have to pray, to reconnect the soul or the body properly, to internalize, so we can face the day with purpose, with meaning, but it takes time. And it's specifically at that moment of kind of emptiness, when we start the day, we make one commitment. We say, I haven't prayed yet, I'm not that excited yet, I haven't tried to understand the deeper meaning of life yet because I just woke up, but Mordeh Ani Lefanecha, I'm yours. I commit throughout the day that I will defer to you and I will try and see the world through your eyes, right? To take it a bit deeper, the mystic explained that we wake up in the morning pretty selfish because our body is the main primary force, like our animal soul, right? Takes time to sort of, and God has a different perspective. We kind of wake up with a bit of a conflict between us and God. Like we're looking at survival and he's looking at purpose. But we say right away, Mordeh Ani Lefanecha, I'm going to come around. I'm going to be deferred to you and come around throughout the day to live this day with meaning and purpose. Now, that sense of humility is a hard type. That's why we say Mordeh Ani. Why? So they explain the following, right? That sometimes you can have a very emotional humility. So for example, let's say someone encounters a very strong and powerful person and you understand the person's power, you understand the person's ability to control you or to be powerful over you or to hurt you, to give you, etc., etc. And once you internalize that understanding, when you're fully understanding, that understanding kind of instills an awe, instills a pachad, a fear of that person, right? Or for example, when a person is in the presence of a great scholar, and a scholar that you understand, you've had a taste, you've learned the person's works, you understand the depth, you understand that he's a scholar of great note, right? And you understand his intellectual greatness and you love it, it talks to you. So when you stand in the presence of that person, you stand with a certain deep respect, right? That's not actually hard, that's much more of a emotional sort of a feeling of humility. It's a feeling of being understood. It's a feeling of respect, a feeling of humility. It'd be the same thing with love. You understand the other person's character. You really like the way they do things. You it resonates with you. It really feels you have a kind of love for them also. Right? That's kind of a emotional love or an emotional humility, emotional respect. Then there's another kind of respect and humility, which is the hard one, and that's much more functional. It's like just a feeling of deference that you just give yourself over. So for example, you're in the presence of someone and you've been told or you hear or you have intuitively know this person's a very great person. You understand nothing of their greatness. You don't feel it. You don't get it. But, sometimes you find with very young people and children that they can be very wild and misbehave when they're in the presence of the principal, let's say, they all of a sudden, they understand the greatness, they think he's a nobody, right? They think that they know better than him, but yet, there's certain intuitive respect that they have because they know either that he's in charge or whatever the case is, right? We find this, like, for example, in many different ways. So, for example, we find this that even if you disagree with the person, so I'll give you a kind of halachic example of this. We find that sometimes if there's a person who's, like, in respect of authority, right? Sometimes you'll have two people who debate a halachic issue, for example. One of them happens to be a leading authority on Jewish law, let's say, right? Another one is a lesser authority, less qualified, but yet great. And they will come to a conclusion, the person who's of lesser sort of a stature or lower level doesn't actually agree with the person, doesn't understand the authority of the greater, he understands the authority, but doesn't understand the conclusion of the greater person. And yet he defers to him, because he's in charge, he's the authority. I don't actually understand, I don't necessarily agree even, but I defer, because he's in charge. That's kind of what. Now, on the surface, because it's the same thing with the Modeh Ani in the morning, right? When we wake up in the morning, we have very little understanding of God's greatness. That's just the way the day works. As I said before, we're still pretty numb. We haven't internalized anything yet, right? It's not like we have a whole intellectual and emotional sort of structure of why we feel humble before God, or why are we surrendering to God, or why we commit to come around to His way of thinking. So what do we do in the morning? It's just a very functional humility. Modeh ani lefanech. I'm submitting to you. I'm yours. All right? So like with Netzach, on the surface it seems very simplistic. It seems very, not very deep. Right? And yet, it actually comes from a very deep place, just like Netzach. Because it's actually a humility, it's a submission, I mean positive submission, and we'll explain it a bit later, that comes from a place that's very deep within our soul that transcends ego. Like, why don't we want to be humble? That's because we're egocentric, right? We have an ego. But sometimes intuitively, in fact, spiritually speaking, the spiritual humility that we talk about in Modeh Ani comes from a very deep place of the purity of our soul. That even though we don't really appreciate it, we don't really understand it, but it's part of who we are. Much has been spoken about the sentence of Modeh Ani that we say in the morning. Modeh Ani is not an expression of understanding or emotion, but it's actually an expression of who we are. I don't really understand, but I know that's me. I'm connected. So it expresses itself in a very simple functional way, but actually comes from a very deep place. It's a very deep humility. It's what we call in Hebrew, bitul. It's surrender, it's giving ourselves over, letting ourselves being led, because that's actually who we really are. Sorry, that's me. Okay, now. And like Netzach, it allows us to be connected even when our emotions are not working. So in other words, deep down in the morning when we wake up, or if we ever like have questions, or we don't understand, or we often have questions. Everyone has questions. Nowadays people have lots of questions because things happen individually, collectively, that we have questions, right? And therefore maybe we don't have that feeling of humility in an emotional way. We don't understand. We're not, it's not working for us kind of things on an emotional level. So why do we still do it? Because we have emunah. Where does emunah come from? That deep humility. It comes from that deep surrender. It comes because that's who we are. Can we explain it? Not really. It comes from a very deep and pure place. And that's the Modeh Ani of a Jew. That's why we start the day with Modeh Ani. It's one of the reasons. Besides the power of starting the day with gratitude, but it's also a very powerful expression and foundation of our Jewishness that we start the day with that sense of humility. Now, what does humility look like? Let's understand humility. So there was a great, and this is a very foundational concept, and then we'll talk about how God works with Netzach. There was a great Hasidic rabbi, his name was Reb Simcha Bunim of Shischa. He lived a couple hundred years ago. And he said that he has two pockets, and in each pocket there's a note. And those notes are quotes from the Chumash or from the Talmud. Two quotes. What's the first quote? In the one pocket he has the quote that Abraham Avinu said when he was debating Hashem, and he came close to Hashem and he said, I'm sorry to ask you this question and I feel very humble, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because he was challenging God not to destroy the city of Sodom, right? But on the other hand, Abraham Avinu was incredibly humble before Hashem, and he said the expression, Anochi afar va'efer. I'm like dust, I'm like a speck, I'm nothing. That's what Avraham Avinu said. I'm nothing. And he said it in the words, Anochi afar ve'efer, I'm like dust and ash. Right? That's what he said. And that's written in the Torah. And Rav Simcha Bunin Rav Shischa had that written on a piece of paper to remind himself about his nothingness in one of his pockets. What did he have in the other pocket? In the other pocket he had a saying from the Talmud that a person should always say, Bishvili nivra ha'olam. The world was created for me. Not quite like I'm dust and ash, right? The world was created for me. Now some people take this very literally, by the way, right? But we'll soon explain it's not actually meant that way. Right? But that's what it says, the world was created for me. So when I was a child, and I heard the story, the way it was taught to me and the way I understood it then on a very simple level is like kind of the issue was balance. Balance, you know, you gotta balance. A bit of humility, a bit of sense of self, you know. It's a balance. So he wanted to balance out the two things. The two things have to work together. So he said, Anochi afar ve'efer. On the one hand, I'm nothing, but I'm also something, kind of, right? I'm nothing, but the world was created for me, so I'm not exactly nothing, so it's a bit of a balance, right? Balancing out the humility, maybe too much humility is not good. But as I learned more, and I matured a bit, hopefully, I came to realize that actually it's not a balance at all. It's nothing to do with the balance. They work together, but it's not a balance, and when they work together, they mean something entirely different. That in fact, each one is meant in its extreme. And that's how they work together. Anochi afar ve'efer means literally. I'm not saying that we're all at that level where we actually feel that way, but anochi, when Avraham Avinu said that he meant it seriously, we'll see what he meant and what he meant by that. But anochi afar ve'efer means I am actually nothing. I'm a speck on the whole spectrum. Right? What does that mean? And then we'll see how that inspires the other saying of the Talmud that the world was created for me. So anivut, humility as it's called, what does it actually mean? Humility means that a person understands that he's not self-made, that he's not an independent creation, right? That he's part of a much greater reality, and that is everything that we have is God-given, our skills, our talents, our existence, our blessing, our sustenance. Everything is completely dependent on the existence of God. And in fact, on an independent level, our existence is extremely weak because we couldn't exist without the continuous creative power of Hashem. That's what humility means. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't acknowledge what we have. We have certain levels of intellectual competence. We have skills. We have talents, which we might be very talented. We might be very clever. We might have done and achieved an amazing amount. But we are completely humble about it because we understand that it's all a gift. It's something that God gave us or allowed us to achieve or allowed us to express. Number one. And number two, we also understand that it wasn't given to us for self-absorption and to become a better I, a greater I. It was given to me for purpose, to achieve purpose, to live a life with meaning and purpose. Right? Okay. So, what does that mean? If I understand that I'm afar va'efer, I'm dust and ashes, meaning I'm just a I'm like, in the scheme of things, I'm a tiny speck. What does it mean I'm nothing? I'm not an independent, I'm not self-made. It actually makes me greater, not smaller. Why? Because what am I? I'm part of God's existence. Everything about me, everything that I have, is dependent on God's creative power and a gift from God, which means I'm part of His reality. If I'm part of His reality, I actually have greater power, greater infinity, greater strength, greater eternity. That makes sense with me? Yeah? Because I'm part of, as an independent being, I'm just a speck among billions of specks. I'm really nothing, like Avraham Avinu said. I don't have anything independent, which is, thank God, because if I did, I'd be very weak. Which is why I've explained to you in previous times that sometimes when people have an arrogance, it actually comes from an insecurity. Because arrogance is about, I'm just me and I achieved everything and it's all about me. And that me is a very, very fragile existence for which I have to really protect all the time, which breeds ego and arrogance, and I'm very protective of it, right? But if I understand that everything I have and every gift that I have, and by the way, that's one of the interpretations I mentioned last week, that Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble of all people. One of the reasons for that, it says in many commentaries, is because he knew exactly that he was the greatest prophet. He knew exactly that his talents and his genius and his leadership qualities and everything like that. But he understood that's all a gift from God. In fact, Moshe Rabbeinu thought, it says in many places, that if someone else had the same opportunities, maybe he'd do better than it. Right? Because not his opportunities, it's what's given to him from God. Our job is just to nurture what God has given us. So I'm just a speck, and it's all God-given, and it's all from God, and therefore I'm just part of that greater reality, an infinite reality. The question is, if I am afar ve'efer, if I'm on an independent level, nothing, I'm just a nothing, independently that is, so why am I here? You know why I'm here? Because I'm part of that collective mission and I'm part of that collective purpose. And I'm here because Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. The world was created for me. What does that mean? There's no me. So what does it mean the world was created for me? Meaning because everything I have is given to me by God. It was given by God for a reason, for a purpose, for a mission. And everyone was given different talents and different skill sets and different opportunities. I have to understand that the world depends on me. This nothing, the world depends on it. Why? Because it's all that I have is all God-given for a purpose and for meaning. And God gave every person a unique mission. A unique mission means that I have a unique contribution to make to the overall plan and overall mission that no one else can actually contribute to. I can give something that no one else could give. Right? I can make it happen. And what I contribute, I can make happen with Netzach. Netzach we spoke about last week. I can be strong about it. I can do it. Why? Because I have that deep, because I'm connected to an infinite power. I have infinite power. I have infinite potential. So therefore, I can overcome obstacles. I'm not a weak existence. Why? Because I'm not an existence independently. I'm part of a greater reality. Anochi afar va'efer. Because I'm all godly given and godly inspired and godly created. And therefore, that mission, that unique mission, that one that no one else could do, that God gave me and you, is something that I can achieve and I can make it happen. It might be difficult, it might seem difficult, it might be external challenges, but I have that netzach, I have that drive to be able to do that. I can overcome it. I can do it. So, b'shvili nivra ha'olam, the world is created for me, and I am dust, is not balance. On the contrary, anochi afar ve'efer is in the extreme, that I have no independence, it's all about what God gave me. It's all part of God's reality and infinity and power. And therefore, why am I here therefore? Because I have a unique mission. If I'm just random, if I just landed here, well, maybe you just landed here just the same. So, and maybe I'm not very finite. Maybe I can't. Maybe I don't care what happens to the rest of the world. No. But anochi afar ve'efer, real humility, gives me a sense of greater responsibility. Because I'm now part of God's infinite existence, and He gave us a purpose, and He gave us a direction, and He gave us a goal, and He gave us a mission. And He gave each of us a unique way of contributing to that mission. He gave us universal laws, He gave us, we're under the umbrella of common laws and things like that, but everyone has their unique contribution. Right? That's why we celebrate Shavuot next week, and we stood at Mount Sinai. And God said, I've mentioned this before, and He said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God of the Ten Commandments. And He spoke in the singular. He spoke in the second person singular. I am Hashem, your God. You know, but in Hebrew, singular and plural is different words. Elokecha means I'm your God, singular. Elokechem means I'm your God, collectively. He didn't say Elokechem. There were 3 million people standing there, and all the future souls. He should have said Elokechem, not Elokecha. But He spoke to every individual. Every individual says, I'm your God. Everything you have comes from me, but I've entrusted you with a special mission, a unique mission, one that no one else can accomplish. And you matter. You matter not because you're an arrogant person, you matter because you're humble, because you're part of my infinite purpose, and therefore there's so much space for everyone, and there's a unique contribution that everyone can make. Yeah? Are we making sense so far? Yeah. So first of all, the soul is eternal.
Your mission.
So your mission hopefully is completed. Right. That's why. That's part of what we learn. You know, we right now in the period of the Omer, where we have this mitzvah to count days, right? We count the 49 days. One of the lessons of counting the 49 days is to value each day. And to know that we're only in this planet for a limited amount of time, and we need to try and make the best of it and try and reach our mission as best we can. Right? There's a... And it's an interesting thing. The mission is... although the soul is eternal, but the mission is specifically accomplished in this world. Because the purpose of creation was this physical world, that God wanted to fix this world and be revealed in this world, right? Sorry?
No, just that how do we know what our mission is?
That's a good question. Okay, so it's a very good question. I mean, it's probably a discussion for a whole nother share, but very briefly, so far we do have a common mission, which we do differently, but we have a common mission, which is our Jewishness. God gave us a Torah, gave us a moral compass, and part of the mission is adhering to that moral compass, right, as best we can. But then, of course, there's each person. So it always has to be in the context. So like when we want to do something, so as a Jew, the first question we ask is that in line with the overall mission, right? In other words, does the Torah sanction this? So part of our mission is, within the guidelines that our moral compass provides for us, is to maximize the talents that we have, the calling that we have. I'll give you a simplistic example. So we know there are many, many things in Judaism which are universally important, right? I'll give you two examples. So to learn Torah is a mitzvah, for example, right? So one of the things is to acquire wisdom, God's wisdom, right? Which is learning, understanding. Then there's a thing which everyone has to do. We have to be generous. We have to help others. We have to have chesed, kindness, right? Okay. So let's say a person has got time on his hands. Okay, he's got 5 hours each day. So which one should he do? Should he sit and learn, or should he go help people? They're both important. We know we can give a shiur on each one. Why they're both important, right? So the answer is everyone has to do both. But in terms of what your area of emphasis becomes, which is about your mission, really, it depends on who you are. Some people, that's their calling, to help other people. Some people are scholars and they devote more time to learning. Now, everyone is obligated to do both, because learning Torah is a mitzvah and chesed is a mitzvah. But it might depend on the person's personality, where that area of emphasis is going to be. Right? Sometimes our purpose is dictated to us by what we call hashgacha pratit. Lubavitch Rebbe was very into this. He would always, when someone would live in a place, unless it was a very good reason to move, you'd always encourage people to stay where they are. Why? I mean, there are obviously reasons for people to move, but he was always very much, because it says that God leads the person to where they need to go, right? And therefore, they have a mission there. That's their contribution. They have to make that place work. They have to bring light and kindness and values to that place or that experience, right? I'll give you an example. You know, there were very often... I used to watch videos of people, of the Rebbe talk to people, asking the Rebbe advice in different contexts. Sometimes there'd be someone who'd like have a big business, for example, a businessman, and he was very, very successful, come to the Rebbe. I remember this video. He came to the Rebbe and he says, you know, he really wants to actually stop. He's got kind of enough to live on, so he'd like to now stop, retire, which, by the way, the Rebbe wasn't very into retirement at all. He didn't think that was a good idea. All part of the same idea, because we're here to work, we're here to accomplish. Right? And he wants to now just dedicate hours each day, he wants to learn, he wants to study. The Rebbe said no. The Rebbe told him no, because of course you have to study each day, and he was very supportive of studying and encouraged studying. He said, God has led you to this path. He's led you to be successful. Keep at it. And then use your wealth for good. You are successful. God has given you success. He hasn't given it to you to... That's a purpose. Right? That's the whole idea here. That everything we have is God-given, and it's for a purpose. So therefore, sometimes your mission is determined by where it takes you. So like you are successful, he said to him. You have wealth. Be more successful. Keep working at it. And use your resources to help people. So again, it has to do with our personality, it has to do with where we're taken, it has to do with our experience. Sometimes just we get put into things and we know that's our mission. Like we gotta, right? And then of course there are a lot of gray areas, and that's why I come back to what I always tell you is there in Pekei Avot it says that we have to have a mentor, we have to have friends, because we are very biased and we're very subjective. And therefore sometimes when we go to people that are higher higher up than us, and we defer to them, we help them. Not, they don't tell us what to do, but they guide us in terms of what our mission is. Like, by asking us questions, by sort of getting us thinking and trying to work it out. But we do our best. We have to sometimes just, we have the rules, we have the foundations, the values that we're supposed to adhere to. The specifics of it, we have to work out. And it's hard work sometimes. There is that, I think I've told you that story, that there is sometimes that we end up doing things we're not supposed to do. There's a very famous story told by the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov said that there were two people in this world that they came after 120. They came up to Shamayim, and they were quizzed and interrogated, so to speak, and turned out they were both very, very good people, but they were called, he called it neshamot hatoot. In Yiddish you say fablonjit, meaning they lost their way. What do we mean lost their way? The story was like this. There was a very wealthy guy, and he was going to a city which had a big business fair, and he took a balagola. Balagola means a wagon driver, right? And the wagon driver, but it brings out a point. And they were both very good Jews, very, very devout Jews. And the wagon driver set up, and he was a poor wagon driver, taking this big, big businessman to this fair. And they got a bit stuck, and it was very far away. Anyway, they got stuck in a shtetl for Shabbos. It was Friday afternoon, but if they were really going to go to the next city, but then it would be too late, it would be Shabbos already. So they stopped in the city. Okay. So they got off and they started walking to the, finding a place to stay, and a motel, and going to shul, whatever the case is. So suddenly the wealthy man, that's why I said also got to do with who we are sometimes, we have to think sometimes, right? So the wealthy man hears screams in the background, coming from a distance. So he follows the screams, someone looks in distress, we've got to help out. Comes and he sees another balagol, another wagon driver whose wagon and horses were stuck in the mud. And it's his whole livelihood, and he's distressed, and he's screaming, and he needs help. He says, of course, helping another Jew, what bigger mitzvah could be? Let me help you. The problem is this wealthy guy knew nothing about horses, right? So he starts to pull and to shove, and he's getting kicked by the horse, and he's the mud on his things. And anyway, by the time he's finished there, he comes to shul. He's like they say, he goes to his hotel, and he's like, Hatzebrochene, you know, he's completely bashed up. He didn't really help the guy properly anyway, and he was doing a mitzvah, right? Okay. What did the balagola do? What did the wagon driver do? He checked into a very, very simple motel. He didn't have a lot of money. And he went to the shul to get ready for Shabbos. Didn't have anything else to do. He went there to prepare, learn the parsha of the week, I don't know. And people came to shul. Now, it used to be that the custom in the shtetl was that in shul, people who came to stay in a town, like beggars or people didn't have where to eat, they would come to shul on Friday night, and there was always a system that by the end of the davening, they were all invited out. They all had where to eat. So this balagola is a very good Jew. He wants to do kindness. So he was there early. So as soon as these guys come who need a place to stay, who need a place to eat, he invites them all to his motel room for Shabbos. Right? They come to his motel room. He hasn't got much. So they come to him. He was very nice. He invited 10 guests. But they all left hungry because he didn't have much to eat to feed them. Right? So when they came up to Shamayim, they were told like this, that you guys mixed it up. If you would have called the wagon driver to go help out the wagons, and the rich man would have gone to shul and invited the guests that, with all the food that he had and the resource that he had to come Friday night, the horses would be out of the mud successfully, the guys would have had what to eat. Right? So you stick to your mission. Sometimes you have to know, if you're not able to do something, don't try and do it. Then it's not your mission. We can talk about that in a second. Okay, so we have our mission. So again, humility means that I surrender to God's plan. I understand it's all from Him, and I understand that therefore I have a unique mission. All that I have, I'm not arrogant about it, because it's a gift from Him, and it's a guidance from Him, and it's a calling from Him, bishvili nivra ha'olam, to know that the world was created for, everyone has their world, and the world was created for your mission, and you have to get to work. However, what we have to understand, one of the greatnesses of coming to it through this perspective, is that there's no ego, there's humility, which means that although the world was created for me, and I have my unique mission, but I'm part of a whole. And if I'm part of a whole, there's plenty of room for everyone, right? And therefore, I tolerate other people. I'm humble about other people. I respect other people. And I make room for other people, because if we're all part of that, if I'm just me, then there's not a lot of room. It's hard for me to make room for others. But if I'm part of God's greater plan, God's greater reality, God's greater infinity, there's endless room for everyone. And that's where Netzach and Hod come together. And let me try to go through this on time. So, Netzach is on the right side. So Netzach is about being ambitious. It's about being strong, in particularly in light of what we just said. That Bishvili Nivra Olam, I have a unique mission, and therefore I've got to get to work. And then suddenly I know what I've got to do, and I know which mitzvah I've got to keep, and I know who I have to help, and all that kind of stuff. And then suddenly I lose enthusiasm, or things come in the way, and there's obstacles. We have to be like Rabbi Akiva. We have Netzach. We are ambitious. We're going to win the war. We have a sense of winning. We have that sense of tremendous ambition. I'm going to get there. I am going to overcome all obstacles. The problem is, this is what I said at the end of last week. The problem is that ambition can go horribly wrong if it's just Netzach. Why? Because often ambition is not pure. Why is the ambition there? Sometimes the ambition comes because I'm jealous of other people. So I need to be the top doctor. Or I need to be the top lawyer. I need to be the most wealthy person. I need to be the most successful person, right? That's where ambition sometimes is fueled from. If it's not fueled by humility, if Netzach is not fueled by Hod, it can go horribly wrong. Because sometimes it can be an outcome of ego. It can be an outcome of jealousy. Which, by the way, jealousy is not such a bad thing. We find in the Talmud that there's good jealousy. There's good jealousy and bad jealousy. Right? There's a famous Mishnah, I've said this to you many years ago, that there's a Mishnah which the Maharal of Prague, the great philosopher, explains in a very unique way. There's a Mishnah that says that jealousy and lust and pursuit of honor can destroy a human being, which of course it can, as we know. Maharal says, but actually, it's the three traits that are very important, depending how you do it. Jealousy is very important, lust is very important, not lust, but desire, wanting things. If you don't have tava, if you don't have a desire, you don't get out of bed. Right? And jealousy doesn't have to be jealousy, it can be aspiration to learn from other people, to grow, to emulate those that are greater than us. So how does it all work? Well, it works like this. When Netzach works with Hod, then we have good ambition, good jealousy, but it's in the context of humility, and therefore there are three conditions. Listen to this. There are three conditions that make ambition and jealousy good. Number one, it's always going to be for a higher purpose, not an empty purpose. Ambition just for the sake of having more materialism, having more wealth, being more prominent, being more successful, just for the sake of being successful, with no purpose, with an emptiness, breeds unhappiness, it breeds emptiness, it destroys the person, and the ambition is unhealthy. How many people do we know that forsake all the priorities of life, they forsake all their values? Why? Because they're busy being ambitious to be successful. Right? They're day and night in why? Because one day they're going to have time to spend with their kids. That's when their kids have grandkids already. But right? Because it never happens. Because like the Talmud says, he who has 100 wants 200. He has 200 wants 400. So there's never an end to this. So therefore they always think, right? One day they ignore the real things of life. So therefore ambition is excellent, but it's got to be for a purpose. It's got to be to be used for a purpose, for a value, for a meaning, for something higher. Number one. Number two, if Netzach is fueled by the purpose in life, by our humility, by the ambition to fulfill our unique mission, then it can never come by undermining people, undermining others. If when we're ambitious, but we do, and we think we're ambitious to do very, very good things, but in the process we destroy other people, in the process we undermine other people, or we belittle other people, or we disrespectful other people, it's definitely wrong. Because ambition that comes from Hod, from a humility, from a submission to a higher being, surrender to God, cannot be that there's no room for the other person. Cannot be such a thing. We find in Torah some good jealousy where the Jews came and they were upset. The first time the Jews brought the Paschal Lamb, the Korban Pesach, when they left Egypt and they built a Mishkan in the desert, and there were some people that were impure, and they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, why is everyone else has the opportunity for the spiritual experience? Lama nigara, why are we losing out? And it was considered a good jealousy, and that's why God gave a gift of a second Pesach to make it up, just in case you couldn't do it the first time. Why is that good jealousy? It fulfilled the criteria. It was for a higher purpose. It was about experiencing some spirituality, and it was not that someone else shouldn't do it. So often jealousy is about, I want it. It's not that I want it, I want you not to have it. Because I want to be better, right? That's negative jealousy. They didn't want it. They were very happy for other people's success. We should celebrate the success of others, physical or spiritual. But just sometimes with their value, their knowledge and their wisdom and their priorities and their amazing success in a meaning, purposeful way, we need to aspire. I'm jealous. The Talmud says, jealousy among the scholars breeds wisdom. It's good, like, wow, I saw that person, he's able to learn so well, I want to be like that too, I'm jealous. That's okay, that's a good jealousy. As long as I don't want to undermine him. Right? And the third part of Hod, this is very, very important, is sometimes Hod, is the humility of Hod also breeds another very important component and another very important condition, and that is acceptance. Acceptance that not everything is for you. That's a problem in that story. The rich guy thought he could do everything. You can't. If you can't, if it's not your role. It's not your role. We find in the Torah a very interesting story. We're coming up to it in a few weeks' time, the parasha of the week, the rebellion of Korach. Right? Rebellion of Korach.
He was rich,
it's true. But he also was rebellious, and he went against Moshe Rabbeinu. What was his problem? His problem is he couldn't understand why there's only one Kohen Gadol. So that's one of the interpretations, only one high priest who has the opportunity to go into the Holy of Holies and offer up incense and have this amazing experience of bonding with God in a special, unique way. And Rashi tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu told them a very interesting line. He said, God chose Aharon for that purpose. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I have news for you. Af ani, I also want to be a Kohen Gadol. The fact that you want to be a Kohen Gadol is great, but you can't be, because not your purpose. That's okay. We should have our own life. And it's a good balance, because you know we believe in our infinite potential. We believe that we can overcome amazing obstacles on all levels, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, all these things. But sometimes we have to know that certain things are not our role. There's different unique roles for every person. There's Kohanim, there's Levi'im, there's Israelites, there's men, there's women. Everyone has their unique contribution. Within people, there's tribes, there's 12 tribes of the Jewish people, which not just were 12 tribes biologically, they were also 12 tribes philosophically. Each one had their pathway. We all kept the same Torah, but everyone had their way of doing things, their path. Right? Because part of that, sometimes something needs to be accomplished by someone else, so we have to celebrate that. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I also want to be a Kohen Gadol, but I can't. I'm the leader, right? I should be able to choose whatever I want. No. I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. I took the Jews out of Egypt, but I can't be a Kohen Gadol. That's something that only Aaron could do. And there's things that we could do that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't do. That's okay. Because we each have a unique purpose. So therefore, but all that comes from Hod. Hod is submission, surrender, humility. So we need Netzach and we need Hod. One without the other doesn't work. Netzach is that unique mission we have and the resilience and the determination to make it happen no matter what. To win the war. Coming from a very deep place. Why? Because Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because the world was created for me. Because I have my mission that no one else could accomplish. But it has to be inspired by and in the context of the Chod, which is the humility. To know that the ambition must be for a purpose. Not just to be ambitious for the sake of being ambitious. It's got to be not at the expense of other people. Because then that's not connection to God, that's self-arrogance. Right? If our mission comes because we're part of that greater reality, to come from real humility and surrender, on the contrary, I want to use who I am. Now, I'm not a nothing. On the contrary, I've got great opportunities, great abilities, great talents. I'm going to use them. But it's coming from my God-given gift, and therefore it can't be at the expense of someone else, because there's room for everyone in the God reality. And thirdly, it's got to be with acceptance that not everything is for me. And sometimes when I'm shown that I can't, even something I really want to do, and I think it's important, I think it's part of my value system, and I think it's part of my contribution to the world's purpose, but it's clear that I can't do it, I need to accept that. If it's not for me, it's not for me. If it's not my role, it's not my role. That's why in Kabbalah, you know, I've told you that the various midot, the various emotions, are out of all the 10 powers, they correspond to parts of the body, right? So it says that Netzach and Hod are like the two thighs, the two legs that hold up the body, because they support a role, right? They're not as powerful as Chesed and Gevura, but they come from a very deep place. And what's interesting is that the commentaries write that we find that a child who's born, before they develop the emotions, before they develop intellect for sure, and maturity of emotion, they can walk. That's what one of the first things they do is learn to walk. Sit up and to walk, right? Because that's the foundation. The legs are not the body itself. A person technically could, you know, God forbid, a person missing a part of the body, you're missing part of the abdomen, it's much more serious than you're missing legs, right? But they support the body. They're the foundation of the person's existence. Netzach and Hod has to drive everything that we do. The commitment to do what we need to do and the commitment to do it in the context of humility. So that it's healthy and it's focused and it's for a purpose and it includes others. And has acceptance. That's the structure of the midot. The last two are the Yisod and Malchut, which actually have a connection to each other, but different, which, please God, we will explain in 2 weeks' time when we finish this part of the series. In the meantime, I should have a good week and Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach Shavuot. Again, Shavuot is Wednesday and Thursday, so Chag Sameach. I do. Oh, in Bangkok. I think he's in Bangkok. He's the head Chabad guy. No.
I would love.